It's the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Ever hear of sodium monostearate? Castoreum. How about taurine? They all have something in common. Let's take castoreum, for example. This actually comes from the castor gland of a beaver, which ends up in things like cigarettes, some ice creams, candy, even baked goods. And what they have in common is that they're all ingredients found in popular food products. If you've ever wondered what polysorbate 60 is, and even if you haven't, you won't want to miss this conversation with Patrick DeGesto. He wrote the Wired magazine column, What's Inside? He's an editor at Make magazine, a contributor to The New Yorker's science blog, Elements, and Popular Science, as well as other publications. He's done a number of interesting things, including stand-up comedy. DeGesto's taken his wit and wry sense of humor and sprinkled it throughout this entire paperback titled, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth? From eggnog to beef jerky, the surprising secrets of what's inside everyday products. It's part education and part pure fun. He joins us by phone today from his home in New York. Patrick DeGesto, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So let's go back to castoreum. Would you like to say a little more about it?
Well, I think you've really covered it. It's a secretion from a beaver's gland located, well, it depends on how you want to define it, but let's just say between the back legs. It's sort of similar related to musk, which is, you know, another secretion from deer. It has a very heady type of smell and apparently a very nice flavor if you use it in small enough amounts. Because the entire cigarette industry used only about 8 pounds of this stuff to create a year's worth of cigarettes. That's about 400 billion cigarettes. So a little castoreum does go a very long way.
So let's jump right into the book and talk about one of your favorite products. What would you say that is?
I think it might be Cool Whip, just for the sheer artificialness of the entire thing. It's basically fake whipped cream, which, if you think about it, we do not have a whipped cream shortage in America. We never have. But apparently the folks at Kraft really did think that this was a necessary product back in the early 1960s, and they actually managed it.
I wonder why they thought we needed that.
I have no idea. Remember, this is back in the age when the Jetsons were on TV, when people thought that we would be eating food in, you know, like pill forms, you know, one pill a day. So maybe just the very idea of artificial food was a thing back then. I mean, you had a lot of them going on. Cool Whip is the one that has really lasted the longest.
There's a lot of really interesting scientific information that's presented, like I said, in a lighthearted way, which makes it very entertaining. And I don't mean to downplay the science because there's some real science in here. The book is laid out in two parts. Part one deals with popular products we eat, and part two looks at products we use. And I should say, you're not trying to take down, you know, any American food corporations or scare people. Why did you write the book?
Absolutely not. The idea, we've had a couple of people recently, a couple of authors, put out these books that really do seem, you know, destined to scare people about what they eat. That was never my intention. This was more just geeky fun about, you know, wow, what is inside all these things that we're eating? How does this ingredient combine with that ingredient to make an entirely new product? Some of the things that we've done are completely natural. We take a look at the chemicals inside red wine. I mean, if it's done right, red wine can be, you know, the most organic, natural thing that you have in the course of a day. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you take it into a laboratory and take an analysis of it, you know, it's loaded with natural chemicals. And what are they? And, you know, how do they all work together? I've always found that fascinating. And fortunately, the readers have also found this fascinating. For the longest time, What's Inside, which is the column that this book is based on, was the most popular feature in Wired magazine.
And was your idea, I should add. And you did that column for a number of years.
Yes, from 2006 to 2013, just about a good solid 7 years.
There's a product that you talk about, Doritos Late Night All-Nighter Cheeseburger Chips. I love this. You said you discovered that in your local Target. When you came across it, you asked yourself, how did they manage to do that? Why did they manage to do that?
Exactly. That's the first question. Why? Who sits around saying, you know, it would be great if we made Doritos that taste like cheeseburgers? You can spin out fantasies. You know, did they get a bunch of college stoners together?
Right.
And say, what would you like? And they'd be like, you know, dude, we want cheeseburgers, but we don't want to go out and get them. So we have to put them in Doritos. You know, maybe that works. We have no idea why they did this, but it really was an actual Doritos flavor. It's harder to find now. I think it still exists. And the amazing thing, it really did taste like cheeseburgers. One of the things that I always made sure to do is that for nearly all of these products, you know, there were a few that I didn't. For nearly all of these products, I actually went to the store, bought it with my own money, and actually used these products, you know, to taste what it tastes like, mouthfeel, do you get sick afterwards, things like that. So, yeah, we wound up with a big, giant bag of cheeseburger Doritos chips.
This is Patrick DeGesto. He's written this book, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. It's about the mysterious ingredients found in many popular food items and products we use. And so here's how it works. You take a product, list the ingredients, and explain what they are, how they're used in the product, and list some of its other uses. And you also give a backstory with each product, which talks about the research process, where you got the information, and sometimes what I call your journalistic adventures, where you describe some of the craziness you've encountered in your story quests. Do you have a favorite?
Yes. There are so many that are favorites. The simple rule is that if a company is small or family-owned, they tend to be much more forthcoming. If a company is incredibly large, a big multi-conglomerate, let's go back to Doritos, which is owned by PepsiCo, they tend to be the most recalcitrant. They tend to hide their stuff most completely, not necessarily because they're afraid of their own ingredients. They're more afraid of how this itinerant writer is going to come along and spin their own ingredients. I used to tell them that I was not out to play gotcha. I was just out to, you know, enjoy the geekiness of understanding what these things were. And that didn't seem to mollify them. They weren't too happy about that. To answer your question most directly, I would say my personal favorite would have been eggnog. Now, you look at eggnog on a store shelf, it seems like, you know, one of the more innocuous things, maybe a little heavy in cholesterol, but still, you know, it's a fun product. It turns out that for the past 30 years, eggnog, nearly every commercial eggnog you've bought, has been violating federal law.
Which you have a really good time with in here, too. And they deserve it.
Yes, exactly. What it basically boils down to is back in the 1980s, the FDA said that you shall not put yellow food coloring into your eggnog because that would make it look like there were more eggs in the product than there really are. And that would be fraud. And that would be wrong. And yeah, you can understand that. That makes sense.
Sure.
If you go to the store shelves right now and look at the eggnog that's there, nearly all of it contains yellow food coloring. So you have to ask yourself, okay, there's a law that says no yellow food coloring. They all contain yellow food coloring. What's the loophole?
Right.
And we researched and researched. And this took a solid month. We called food chemists. We called law professors. We called lawyers. We called lawyers who actually work for food companies against the FDA. And we laid the whole thing out for them, and they said the companies are wrong. We would advise companies to stop doing this. And we couldn't find the loophole. Finally, we actually contacted the National Archives down in Washington, and we found a single piece of paper dating from 1982, which said that the law barring yellow food coloring from eggnog will still remain on the books, but it will not be enforced until a hearing can be held in which both sides can get their say. Now, that was 1982, and there is absolutely no record that this hearing was ever held. So that's like 30 years now. No one has held this hearing. Everyone who used to work at the FDA who are expecting this hearing, they're all retired or even dead by now. This hearing is never going to happen. And it sounds like a lot of fun, you know, eggnog, it's a trivial substance, but it does make you wonder how many other foods and how many other regulations are on the books but will never be enforced.
For sure.
It really does make you think.
It definitely does. And that yellow food coloring hasn't been linked to any problems per se. It's just an appearance issue.
Exactly. They almost all use a totally natural yellow food coloring. It's a plant extract, which just happens to look a nice warm orangey yellow. And you find it in loads of foods. It's in cheese. It's farmers actually feed it to their chickens to make the egg yolks yellower. So it's totally natural. It's not harmful. It's called annatto, which you might even find on your spice rack because it's a spice. So technically, even organic farmers can feed this totally natural plant substance to their chickens to make brighter, yellower egg yolks.
So you just mentioned organic. You've also found some interesting things where government agencies are concerned when it comes down to the words natural and organic.
Oh, yes. Technically, there really isn't a working definition of natural. The definition of natural is really interesting because it's almost like freshman-level philosophy. Technically, here it is. Once a food product has been harvested, it is no longer fully natural because it has been processed. Just by, you know, having a human pull it off the tree, it's now not natural. So the FDA basically says, who can say what is natural and what is not? Technically, this is how it ends. The agency does not object to the use of the term natural if the food does not contain added color, artificial flavor, or synthetic substances. Now, remember that, because what they said was contain added color. They are defining added color as added after the fact. So remember how we talked about you could feed yellow food coloring to chickens,
right,
and it would come out in the egg yolks? That's fine, because the chicken produced that. If you were to take the eggs and somehow inject them yellow afterwards, that would be wrong.
Funny how that works. We're going to take a quick break and then continue our conversation with Patrick DeGesto, author of This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. Wanted to let you know about Faith Middleton's Food Schmooze Martini Competition. Statewide bartenders will create innovative martinis. You vote for the Food Schmooze Martini Champion. There is a designated driver discount. There will be great Top Chef noshes and a DJ. And it all starts at 6 p.m. Thursday, June 25th at Simsbury's Riverview. Thanks to Power Station Events. Tickets are $60. You can order now at ctmartini.org. We're talking with Patrick DeGesto about his book, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. It's a humorous and scientific look at some of the interesting ingredients found in food and popular products we use. The book is based on DeGesto's Wired magazine column, What's Inside? So as an example of your sarcasm throughout the book, I wanted to read about the product Beano. You describe an ingredient in Beano, which is potato starch, and you write, like the Kardashians, industrial quality potato starch is a flavorless, odorless, colorless substance that exists mainly to take up space, which I thought was just so clever.
Yes, potato starch does have that quality. It's pretty much just there. You don't know why it's there. It really doesn't do all that much that's worthwhile. But it does exist to take up space. And if you're making a pill, let's say, such as Beano or some other pharmaceuticals, the actual drug portion of the pill is usually very, very tiny, but you need something to swallow. So most of the rest of the pill will be a collection of cellulose or potato starch.
I alluded to the fact that you've had some pretty interesting careers. Can you say more about some of the jobs that you've had in the past?
Well, as you mentioned, I was a, you didn't say this, but I was a fairly unsuccessful stand-up comedian. I tried that in college, and that went sort of well, but I didn't continue that. I've been a computer programmer, a robot programmer for the Federal Reserve Bank. Most people are not aware that most of their money is shuttled back and forth in the vault by robots, simply because they're much more efficient. And I designed experiments that rode on the space shuttle, mission STS-107, the final mission of Space Shuttle Columbia. Some of my experiments were on board.
Wow. Patrick, what is your background?
Really, just a very good journalism degree from Manhattan College with a minor in computer science. And you just combine the two and, take it where it leads you.
I don't know that it would lead everybody to where it's led you, that's for sure. You also give some bonus trivia, like what that little black button is for on the bottom of the Easy Cheese aerosol spread.
Yes. That was absolutely loads of fun for us. That was the first thing we did. The very first column was Easy Cheese aerosol spray cheese. Because once again, this is what we were talking about earlier, the prevalence of like really totally artificial food in the early 1960s. You had Cool Whip and you had this aerosol spray on cheese. What exactly is it? Well, it turns out it is real cheese, or as close as Kraft gets to real cheese. It contains an extra amount of vegetable oil because you want it to be sort of wet and flowy as it comes through the nozzle. And the rest of the can is filled with nitrogen gas. And the nitrogen gas, the cheese is sort of kept in a little baggie attached to the nozzle. And the nitrogen gas actually squeezes the cheese out when you press the nozzle. Now, that little black button at the bottom is very important because, first off, that's how they fill the can with nitrogen from the bottom. Secondly, it turns out that these cans are a serious explosion risk if they ever catch fire. Because one of the bad things about it is that, the cans can explode from the heat, and what you've got is incredibly hot melted cheese flying all over the place, which is only like one step up from napalm. And so you have to be very careful with that. So that little button at the bottom of the can is also a relief valve. If, a pallet of the cans catch fire, the relief valve is supposed to pop out before the cans explode so that the cans won't explode.
Sounds like a brilliant invention.
This requires some real, real forethought, and they did it very well.
You had mentioned how in the research of these products, you would go to the grocery store yourself and buy them with your own money and try them out. I wanted to get you to talk about your Listerine story, because this is the kind of example of what you'll do for a story.
Yes. Well, if you think about it, Listerine and many, many other mouthwashes, if you read the label, it says quite clearly they are something like 35% alcohol. And that's, almost 70 proof alcohol, which is, a good-sized drink.
For sure.
So why don't people drink Listerine and Scope and all the other mouthwashes to get drunk? Well, the simple fact is that there are a great many people who actually do that. The writer Stephen King, in his autobiography, he's confessed that during his really heavy drinking days, his wife accused him of drinking the Listerine, and he swore up and down that he never drank the Listerine. Secretly, he drank the Scope because it tasted better. But there are some people who will go to any lengths, including drinking mouthwash, to get drunk. The government knows this, and they've done a little tweaking to mouthwashes. In order to sell alcohol for consumption, you need a tax stamp, and you need to make sure that it's not sold to people under 18, and it can only be sold at certain times of the day or the week. So rather than go through all those limitations for mouthwash, the mouthwash companies instead poison the mouthwash. They will add all sorts of stomach-churning chemicals that are not really supposed to kill you, but they are supposed to make you so completely sick to your stomach that chances are you will throw up before you've drunk enough to actually get smashed.
And you just had to try this.
Yes, I took basically a shot glass of Listerine, and it was one of those things where I felt so bad that you actually hope that you're going to die.
Jeez.
But you don't actually die from it. It just they've designed this so well that a person who takes a shot glass of Listerine will never take a shot glass of Listerine ever again.
You also looked into heroin, which was kind of interesting to me. But you comment in the backstory that everybody, including your girlfriend, warned you not to try that one.
It is sort of nice to have this real gonzo journalist reputation among your colleagues. And I absolutely drew the line with that.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah, I didn't, at the time, I didn't even know where to go to get heroin. Although I did make sure to go and visit the place in New York City where heroin was first sold legally. Because not many people realize this, that heroin was an actual product made in the laboratories of Bayer aspirin.
Interesting.
The Bayer aspirin people were looking for a better painkiller, and they came up with heroin. This was back before the days when companies had to do serious testing of their products, so they didn't. And eventually they wound up finding out that this stuff was heavily addictive. Addictive, not in a way that it would just like sell more product, but like seriously badly addictive. And so they stopped making it. So yeah, for quite a while, heroin was sold over the counter right here in New York City.
We're talking with Patrick DeGiusto. He's written this book, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. Let's go to one of my favorites, chocolate cherry cordials.
Yes, aren't they wonderful? Chocolate cherry cordials. Now, this is a chocolate candy that has a liquid center with a cherry, an actual maraschino cherry in the middle of it. And, you know, the fun thing is, how exactly are they made?
Right.
Some of them take the easy way out, in which you make just like a little cup of chocolate, and you put the cherry into it, and you fill it with, you know, sugary liquid syrup, and then you put a cap on it. And, that, you know, that's simple enough. That's the easy way to make it. But that always leaves a seam around the bottom, and you could tell that it was made from two pieces. The really, really good chocolate cherry cordials are absolutely seamless.
Right.
You know, that leads to the question, how is it done? It turns out you take a cherry, you put it through all sorts of chemical baths to turn it into a maraschino cherry. Maraschino cherries are not like from the country of maraschino. They're usually from Michigan, actually, but they're steeped in marasca liquor. They are then placed in a sugar-coated, it looks almost like a bullet of sugar. They are completely covered with sugar, and then they are sprayed with invertase, which is an enzyme that is found in saliva. And that saliva enzyme starts to break down the sugar. Now, while it's still all solid, the sugar-coated cherry then passes through this Willy Wonka type of chocolate waterfall that completely coats it without making a seam.
Ta-da.
So you've got this perfect seamless coating that surrounds this sugary bullet with the cherry inside. It's then packaged, and while all this is happening, the saliva enzyme is very slowly starting to convert the hard crystal sugar into sugar syrup.
Isn't that something?
The whole process of conversion takes about 2 or 3 days. So by the time it goes from the factory, you know, onto a truck, onto the store shelves, by the time you buy it, the chemical conversion has already taken place, and you bite into a liquid center with a maraschino cherry in the middle of it. And it's all due to the saliva enzyme. Now, to be totally fair, before anyone gets grossed out, if they're not already, this enzyme is taken from yeast.
Not
it
your
is
mouth.
Not, I want to make absolutely clear, no one came by and actually spit on your cherry. It is an actual yeast extract, totally natural, and it does the same job.
So glad you clarified that. This is Patrick DeGesto. He's written this book, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. It's about the mysterious ingredients found in many popular food items and products that we use. So you've done some pretty interesting research, and some of it, I would say, is kind of disgusting.
Yes, yes. Probably the most disgusting thing that I ever researched was Head and Shoulders. Not the actual product itself. That's not so bad. But do you know exactly what dandruff is?
I do not.
Dandruff is a yeast infection on the scalp. It gets even more disgusting from there. Basically, the little yeasts are on your scalp, and they live off of the natural oils in your hair, and they chew on your skin. So that's what little white dandruff flakes are. They are dead skin that has been eaten by yeast so they can get to the oil in your skin. And the question is, how do you create a shampoo that is strong enough to kill these yeasts without seriously damaging your scalp, without seriously damaging your hair, and without seriously damaging the person underneath all of them? Yeast are very hardy creatures. They don't die pretty easily. So shampoo manufacturers have had to do quite a bit of research to find various chemicals. Most dandruff shampoos are based around the chemicals methylchloroisothiazolinone and just plain old methyl isothiazolinone. These keep not only the yeast in check, but any bacteria that live off of the yeast and might live in the shampoo bottle. All of these come together to kill these creatures on your scalp.
CoverGirl Lash Blast Luxe Mascara. You describe this as the iron oxide to give you those magnetic eyes.
Yes. What exactly is in the stuff that you paint on your eyelashes? For the most part, it's a various collection of iron and other metallic oxides, which just, you know, they are specifically designed to look incredibly black and incredibly lustrous. So you get that sort of pearlescent sparkle in your eyelashes. Most people don't even realize that it's there, but it really does exist, and it really does make the eyelashes look very, very interesting to look at.
True.
So the people who put this together really know what they're doing, but it does make you think, all these iron and metallic oxides on your eyelashes, are there any side effects to this? And there are two.
Hmm.
The most impressive one is that most people don't realize this, but just about any bottle of mascara that you deal with is magnetic.
No kidding.
We were absolutely astounded when we actually tried this. I went to my girlfriend. I said, do you have any mascara? We dug in a drawer and pulled out mascara, and we held a magnet up to the bottle of mascara, and the magnet stuck to the bottle of mascara because there are so many iron and metallic oxides in it. But the other side effect you have to watch out for, because if you go in for a cranial MRI while wearing mascara, the metal in the mascara will actually distort the MRI.
Really?
And you will not get a valid reading. It winds up, and this was actually a problem in the early days of MRIs, it winds up looking like a melanoma on your eye, because it's just this bizarre mass of stuff.
You'd think you'd need a lot for that to happen, but I guess not.
Not very much, no.
This is Patrick DeGesto. He's written this book, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. Now, I want to talk about diamond matches for a second. If I were a business owner, I wish it were this company. Nothing really to keep up on, no technological advances, no improvements to be made.
Matches pretty much stopped evolving in the 1800s, yes.
And because yes. Why?
Because really, they pretty much had reached the apotheosis of matches. It's like you really can't get them any better than they are right now. They are a mixture of many different chemicals that when mixed together and heat is applied, and heat is applied through friction, they will just spontaneously burst into flame. They will burn for a set amount of time. And then I found this absolutely fascinating. Why do most matches go out? You would think that a match, you know, it's on a wooden stick. It's just going to burn all the way through.
Right.
The wooden stick is made of aspen wood. And the fascinating thing about aspen is that it is highly flame resistant. The Forest Service actually encourages people to plant aspen brakes in their woodlands to help stop fires from spreading. So the wood itself is naturally fire resistant. It is then coated with a mixture of molten glass and other chemicals that smother the fire once it gets to the wood. The fire actually melts the glass, which then seals the flame and stops any oxygen from getting to it.
That one was more complicated than I even imagined. You look at the matchstick and you think, yeah, that looks pretty simple, but much more went into that.
Exactly. And, you know, there's so much science and so much chemistry going on in a simple match, which really hasn't changed since the 1800s. So it's hard to think of a way to make a match any better.
Hmm. Is there any sort of conclusion you've come to after all the research you've done? You know, something like everything in moderation? Because there are various times in the book that you point out that certain chemicals used in large quantities could really be harmful, but you'd need some huge amount of that chemical to cause any real harm.
Exactly. I think I know what you're talking about. Let's say Slim Jim.
Right.
Slim Jims are these meat sticks to help keep them fresh on store shelves. They're loaded with sodium nitrates and nitrites. Yes, those can be very bad for you if they are eaten in serious quantities. I think we calculated that it takes something like 1,400 Slim Jims in order to poison yourself with sodium nitrate.
That's a lot of Slim Jims.
Really, no one's going to eat that much in one setting.
Or a lifetime, maybe.
Maybe. And, you know, it does, the chemical does wash out of your body over the course of a couple of hours. So unless you eat 1,400 of them in like 1 hour, it's not going to make you sick. And this is what I think is a little more important. It is so effective at killing bacteria that will grow in, you know, sausages and meat sticks that the benefits of this chemical, you know, from keeping you from getting, you know, botulism poisoning, the benefits are so much larger than the downsides, which you'd only get if you ate, you know, a ton of these things.
And that might be said about some of the other products as well.
Just about everything, yes. You see, the thing is, again, you have all these people who have, as I said, written books recently saying that all chemicals are bad for you. Don't eat anything with a chemical in it. Well, you know, the most organic apple taken off of the tree and brought to a laboratory is loaded with chemicals. It's made of chemicals. We're all made of chemicals. The point is to use these chemicals the right way without, you know, eating 1,400 Slim Jims, you're going to be just fine. You're actually going to be helped by these chemicals because they'll save you from botulism. Mm. If you think about it, there's no CEO who actually sits there and says, let's poison the American public. They don't want you to die. Believe it or not, they don't want you to die because they don't want the bad publicity. If you want to eat, you know, nothing but junk food, well, you have to make that decision that too much of this stuff is going to make you sick. just about everything in moderation seems to me to be a fine way to go.
Well, it's a fun book, and thank you for coming on the show.
And thank you for having me.
Patrick DeGesto is the author of This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth, From Eggnog to Beef Jerky, The Surprising Secrets of What's Inside Everyday Products. Next, a conversation from the Faith Middleton Show archive on the Onion satire of the encyclopedia. I'm Laurie Mack, filling in for Faith.
I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks so much for listening. We're going to talk now with Will Tracy. He is editor of The Onion. And for people who know The Onion and can't stop laughing, The Onion has come out with a book. It's called The Onion Book of Known Knowledge. And they call it the 183rd Imperial Edition. It is everything in the world, by definition, in the Onion way. And you'll see what I mean in just a minute. Will, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So I see that the book is somehow connected to the Zweibel family. Can you explain?
Yes, the Zweibel family.
Zweibel.
Yes. They're the family who control The Onion, which, as you know, is the most powerful media organization on the planet. They've controlled it since its founding in 1756, and they continue to control it now. And in a sense, I guess, they can continue to control all of our lives. You know, we may like to pretend we live in a representative democracy, but really, we live in a plutocracy largely controlled by The Onion and the Zweibel family.
So this book goes A to Z.
Yeah.
And I thought we'd start with A.
Sure.
And I'll just pick something at random here. How about the Campbell soup can? This looks like a Warhol thing. How do you define it?
The Campbell soup can by Warhol. This is a pop art masterpiece by Andy Warhol, who, after becoming an icon, sealed himself inside a wall-mounted frame and sold himself at auction for $29 million.
Did he?
That was probably his most famous piece.
Well, on the same page, because A is for art, you've got a timeline to all the artistic movements. And I did notice that in the 1970s, America became very interested in outsider art.
Oh, yes, of course. Outsider art is it's a term that is coined for any art made by hillbillies, chimps, and mental patients who ran afoul of powerful art critic Robert Hughes and never regained acceptance in the mainstream.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, yeah.
Under B, very intriguing, because you don't only do subjects and things, but you do people.
Yeah.
And, for instance, there's one on Biden here. But I was interested in your explanation and definition of Ingmar Bergman, the filmmaker.
Oh, yes. Let's see here. Bergman, Ingmar, Swedish director and self-described total mourning person who made such films as The Seventh Seal, Shame, and Hour of the Wolf, and who is known for extolling the importance of always keeping one's chin up and looking at the glass as half full. So he's sort of a feel-good director, I think, in the world of world cinema.
And you say he often worked with the same ensemble of actors.
Yeah, he often worked with the same ensemble of actors, handpicked for their easygoing nature and willingness to come in fresh every Monday with great attitudes, always gung-ho about exploring themes of human alienation, loss of religious faith, and insanity. Bergman retired in 2003 and spent the last 4 years of his life learning to square dance and enjoying as much yummy chocolate as he could get his hands on.
You can see how this is a book of knowledge for the young person in the family, just to supplement what they're learning in school.
Absolutely.
To stay with the bees, I thought, now how would The Onion define Buddha?
Let's see here. Buddha, prince born Siddhartha Gautama, who founded the philosophy and religion of Buddhism, something he was only able to accomplish after finally being reincarnated as a human, having spent his first 46 lifetimes as a squirrel. Though the Supreme Buddha has long wished to spread his teachings about reaching enlightenment through the meditation and the subsequent death of desire, the 140 years he spent being reborn as a variety of different species of ground squirrel made it difficult, as he had to relay these complex messages through the limited squeaks and chirps he was able to produce. In fact, he was killed on at least 3 occasions by people who thought he was rabid after he approached them with his message. after finally being reincarnated into a decent human body instead of as another damn squirrel, the Buddha was able to gain large numbers of followers in the 5th century BC, though a very small minority of adherents continue to worship him in his squirrel form.
And then there's a definition of Buddhism itself, which we don't need to go into, but I think you get the idea. Under D, I thought, oh, this is interesting. Let's see what The Onion does with Walt Disney.
Walt Disney, American film producer, writer, animator, voice actor, and entertainer, who is renowned for his childlike enthusiasm for money.
And under, I might as well move on to another letter, because I'm really kind of stuck on the B's. So under H, let me see, this goes from HIV to hurricane, so I can only imagine. Homosexuality, what does The Onion do with it? How do you define it?
Homosexuality, comma, sexual attraction between politically conservative or evangelical white males. Homosexuality is characterized by wearing navy blue or gray suits with red ties, frequent church attendance, and public denunciation of other homosexuals. So that's our definition there.
Yeah. You're saying here that many homosexuals occupy positions of authority.
Yes, and can be found working as Republican school board members, Republican activists, Christian men's group leaders, and Republican legislators. Prominent homosexuals include Roy Ashburn, former California state senator and anti-gay activist, Larry Craig, former U.S. senator from Idaho and anti-gay activist, Ted Haggard, evangelical pastor and anti-gay activist, and George Allen Records, minister and anti-gay activist.
Okay, so I think that's self-explanatory.
Yes, absolutely.
Under K, this goes from everything from keyboard to Jack Kirby.
That's right.
You've got Genghis Khan, Mount Kilimanjaro, John F. Kennedy,
sure.
Kinetics. But I come to the definition of Billie Jean King, who was born November 22nd, 1943.
That's right. Billie Jean King, a former professional tennis player famous for 1973's media-dubbed Battle of the Sexes match in which she defeated Bobby Riggs in straight sets, proving that a woman could beat a man. King then went on to play in similar matches, such as the Battle of the Children, in which King showed that a female could beat a 5-year-old boy on the hard court, the Battle of the Plumbers, which demonstrated that a female had every right a man had to be on the same court as a plumber, the Battle of the Disfigured, in which King handily defeated a man whose body was covered with second and third degree burns, the Battle of Nature, in which King prevailed over a giant freshwater sponge, 6-0, 6-1, and the legendary Battle of the Machinery, in which the 12-time major winner showed the world that an assembly line robotic arm from a Detroit auto plant was no match for a woman. Though King's success was inspiration to women across the country, she lost a second Battle of the Sexes match to Chris Evert in the 1977 Wimbledon quarterfinals, proving that a woman could not beat another woman at tennis.
Okay. One of my heroes, by the way, in sports.
Oh, yeah.
I would love to be in the room watching her read that for the first time. So what was the idea of putting this book together? How did you all do this?
We knew we wanted to do another original book, and so we kind of try to get different concepts, and a lot of the concepts we came up with were sort of very high concept things that were funny but maybe felt a little bit limited. And the idea of an encyclopedia, which it's not necessarily the newest thing under the sun to do a parody encyclopedia, that kind of thing has been done before, but I think the appeal for us was A, making it look as much like an actual encyclopedia as possible. It's a very kind of dense-seeming book. If you look at the cover, it kind of looks like a volume of Encyclopedia Britannica. There's nothing about it that necessarily screams comedy book. So we thought we could bring that kind of verisimilitude to it. And also the fact that it was not limiting at all. With a fake encyclopedia, you can make a joke about literally anything in the known universe. So we didn't have to limit it to, like, news or history or science.
No,
it was everything.
It's comprehensive. I was thinking, how did they divide these up among the staff? Who gets what?
We all came in with ideas for entries. There was stuff that we knew we had to hit, kind of the big ones, you know, an entry on God or World War II or
cancer.
Medicine.
You did cancer.
Exactly. Things like that were like, okay, we obviously, any encyclopedia has to hit these. So we had those, and then beyond that, people were just encouraged to come up with takes for anything. Or if we were light on entries for the letter J, it's like, hey, can someone write some more J entries? And then once we picked takes that we liked, then it was sort of like writers would just say, hey, can I write that one or that one? And then it was done in a pretty organic way. And it was actually like a fairly, in comparison to past books that we've done, it was a fairly painless process.
Do you farm some of these out, or is it straight from everybody on staff?
There were some, there were some contributors, freelance contributors for the book. Most contributors would pitch take ideas for entries, especially later on in the book writing process when we really had to work on just filling it out. But most of the actual entries, full entries, were written by staff members. But it was sort of a mix of both.
So let me ask you this thing that goes around all the time. I know you hear this about women in comedy. And so how many women do you folks have on staff?
Well, first of all, we have a very small staff. We actually only have about 6 writers on staff, and one of the writers is a woman.
So what do you think about that debate about the more women who are behind the scenes, the less sexist these things are going to get? What do you think?
I would imagine that's probably true. I think The Onion, you know, I mean, maybe it's easy for me to say this, but I do think The Onion has always had an eye towards not being misogynist, or if we portray misogyny as we do in the book, it's an incredibly exaggerated version that's obviously meant to be a satirical comment on misogyny. So I absolutely think that's true, and that's why it's one of many reasons why it's a really bad idea to have all male writing staff. I mean, which... You know,
which you almost do.
Which we almost do at the moment, but, you know, The Onion has had...
Things could change.
Well, things have changed for the worse, because The Onion has had female editors-in-chief and female head writers. And
yeah, good point.
The Onion has always had that kind of history. It just happens to be, honestly, by pure happenstance, because the women who I just named left. We were left with a position where, like, we just didn't have any. And it's certainly not by design. It's something that just happens, and it's unfortunate.
So how do you handle it when you're doing something serious, a serious subject? For instance, you did cancer, and you did it in a great way,
mm-hmm.
about everybody calm down and don't worry about anything. That seems to be the,
right.
you know, the new mantra, because we have all these drugs available now.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you did the September 11th attacks, and there's a, you know, a disturbing picture of smoke coming out of the towers. How do you think about that on staff?
You know, we actually, maybe sounds weird or kind of macabre, but I think in a way we almost look forward to covering stories like that, because, first of all, we're usually the first people with something really tragic. We'll have some of the first comedic comments on it from like a major comedy outlet, and I think we like having that role of being maybe the first people to try to tackle it and showing that we're not afraid of trying to tackle something like that. I think we try to look at it as an opportunity not to necessarily be hugely laugh out loud funny, although we always try to find an angle where we can be, but to make a comment that actually feels in a way almost cathartic and therapeutic and makes people say like, oh, okay, it's okay to laugh about this, or, oh, that actually made me feel better because the target was right. So you just have to be very careful about who or what the target of your joke is. But you can make a joke about anything.
And it's often where you get your political digs in, right?
Absolutely. And sometimes it's just a dig, maybe not so much about a specific politician or political party, but a dig about how the media covers events and how the media covers tragic events, which is oftentimes flawed or silly or absurd.
So is there a formula in comedy about the use of swear words where you want to appeal to a certain age group, you've got to have a certain number of them to make it seem appealing to that
right.
crowd? So what's your formula?
The formula, I guess, is just what phonetically sounds funny. I mean, the consideration is never like, oh, younger readers like swears. It's more sort of like, is this sentence funnier with the addition of this word or is it not? I mean, sometimes it just helps with the flow of the sentence and just adds that extra beat and adds that kind of like phonetic sound that just makes it sound funnier. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I have to make a real consideration of like, this is just too many. And maybe throwing in a curse word here is actually just sort of easy. And so it's just always kind of a balancing act.
Great to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on the show,
Thank
Will.
Thank you for having me on.
Our pleasure. So Will Tracy and The Onion has come out with The Onion Book of Known Knowledge. It's a satirical encyclopedia. The Faith Middleton Show airs at 3 and 9 p.m. on WNPR. Check out our guest lineup and join the conversation with us and other listeners on Facebook. Just search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to our talented team, producer Jonathan McNichol and senior producer Lori Mack. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.